Welcome to episode number 31 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Conrad Weaver, and I'm grateful that you've stopped to listen and to watch this show, and I hope you are prospering and thriving in your life. Marlon Baracci is a retired police sergeant from the LAPD. He is a subject matter expert in several subjects, including administrative police misconduct and categorical use of force investigations with an emphasis in officer-involved shootings. He provides expert testimony in internal affairs investigations and renders fair, reasonable, and impartial recommendation on adjudication and penalty of completed investigations. And today, he's right here on the First Responder Wellness Podcast. Join me in this compelling conversation about police misconduct and the investigations that follow. I think you'll enjoy this conversation, so please stay tuned. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the podcast, and I'm grateful for everyone who's joining us on YouTube. If you're on the podcast audio app like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, I want to invite you to join us over on YouTube where you can watch this interview and all the others. Plus, we have a ton of additional content, including my series recap from my Coast to Coast bicycle tour this past summer. That's a lot of fun. So come on over and subscribe to the Wellness Channel on YouTube, and I'll see you there. Thanks again for listening and watching. And now here's my conversation with Marlon Baracci. Well, Marlon, good morning and welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast. I'm so glad that we were able to connect, and it's good to meet you.
Conrad, thank you. Pleasure being here. Early rise over here in the city of Los Angeles. So yeah. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about who you are and what do you do? What's your connection to first responders?
Let's see, a trip down memory lane. How about 24 years with the Los Angeles Police Department. I retired last July, July of 2022. So it's coming up on 2 years, man. It happens that quick. And in those 24 years, I made sergeant in 2007. So 15 years of my career, right when I finished, I got involved in police discipline and police misconduct. And to the point where I gained the expertise, I gained that experience, and I teach it now. We have a California post-certified course. It's a two-day course that I teach with the Savage Training Group. And throughout my journey in the world of misconduct, I've realized that there's a lot of emotions that comes with officers who face discipline in a sense that some don't deserve it, some do deserve it, but more often than not, that ones that don't and they go through this entire process really suffer a lot in terms of coming back to work and trying to reintegrate back with their peers, with their bosses. And so, yeah, that's pretty much wrapped around in what I do with LAPD. I mean, of course, I work patrol, I worked other assignments, but more than anything, police discipline is what's on my belt, you know, as the major tool, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I want to dive into that, but I want to go back a little bit. I'm always curious, how you got into police work? What was that journey like and why?
I was in the United States Navy and I did not want to reenlist. I'm a late bloomer. I'm a high school dropout. I had no guidance, no direction, an absent father. And so what I ended up doing between the ages of 17 when I dropped out of high school, because I just got tired of like asking my mom for money to you know, just to go out and, you know, and to live, you know, the social life, if you will. At 24, 25 years old, my best friend was like a manager of a parking structure at a medical facility. And I decided at 24, 25 to go into the Navy. And so when I went in the Navy, shortly thereafter, my best friend decided to look into becoming a Los Angeles police officer. And so he went on a ride along. And my last year in the Navy, I'll never forget this. I would show a lot of interest, like, hey, man, what's this like? And he told me, you know what? This is the best decision I ever made. I can see the fact that he was very, very excited, very driven, motivated to this type of profession, which is something I never really thought. But you know what? best friends and people who you grew up with are very influential mm-hmm. in the decision making, especially when you're a teenager. And, you know, and if you become, if you maintain that friendship throughout, you know, your teens and into your 20s. And so I was up for reenlistment. I didn't want to do it. And I applied right after my best friend has 2 years on me. And believe it or not, I actually retired before he did. So my decision making has a lot to do with my best friend who really influenced me. I was a bit nervous. I didn't know if I wanted to carry a gun. Those are the things that were going on at the time. I didn't know if I wanted to live with the fact that perhaps one day I might get involved in a critical incident, an officer-involved shooting, for that matter, and live with that controversy or live with the fact that, you know, I had to make a split-second decision. And so for me, I was nervous. I never pictured myself in uniform and protecting and serving in the community. However, once I went into the written exam and I started doing the process, man, all that nervousness just became very, I was very driven, very, very motivated and committed to getting this done. So yeah. And that happened back in, I was late of 1997 and all of 1998. And I got appointed to the, LAPD Academy in July of 1998. So.
Wow. So that's
proud,
a kind of
proud alumni.
A tale of, you know, be careful who you pick as friends, because that can influence you, right?
Yes, absolutely. What's that old saying? Monkey see, monkey do. You know what? I never really, besides saying it, I never really understood what that meant, besides the fact that, hey, you know what? Your friends have such an impact. Mm-hmm. I should say a powerful impact in the decision making that you do. And that goes with any type of profession, right?
Sure.
I mean, you might have a best friend who's working real hard at becoming a professional athlete, and you're right by their side and you're telling each other, we're both going to make it and we're both going to be pros, or known a different than the culture in terms of gangs, right?
Yep.
You might be in a neighborhood where there's a subculture that you can't get out of, and perhaps what your friends do is exactly what you're going to do just to fit in or just for the pressure, you know, because you don't want to be bullied. You don't want to be looked at. You don't want to be seen or looked at differently from everybody else. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's something that as my kids were growing up, it's something I kind of hammered into their brain, is like, you know, you are who you hang with. And I'm sure as you later in your police work and you started working with officers who were making mistakes and, you know, getting in trouble, that probably plays true for those officers as well, for people in uniform, that you are kind of who you hang with. And if you hang with the wrong crowd, you're going to find yourself getting into situations that may not be the best or may get you into trouble.
Absolutely. We can talk about police culture, right? They call it organizational culture. I like to describe it as cop culture. You're 100% spot on that. I'm a true believer that incidents, these major critical incidents like the George Floyd incident, and we can even attend to the Memphis PD, that incident that happened not too long ago with those officers, were seen on video just doing some horrible stuff, which I believe that's not even police work.
Right.
That's not a function that you actually learn. Or you get trained on. So to me, a lot of critics, a lot of experts will claim that it's, hey, it's training, you know, it's training. Maybe it's, and because of this, we should do police reform. Maybe it's a recruitment. It's the fact that people who are coming on the job are not the ones that should be doing, you know, police work. But that's not the case. I mean, I'm a high school dropout, and look at me. I turned out with an awesome, thankful, blessed 24-year career with the LAPD. I like to think of it as cop culture. You know, it dictates what you do and what you don't do. To your point, you're going to get a field training officer who is going to teach you, or supposed to teach you, to do the right thing. And if that particular training officer starts cutting corners, you know, you have to fit in. And next thing you know, you're cutting corners. Once you're done with that field training officer for a couple of months, then you go to another field training officer. And if that particular field training officer also cuts corners and doesn't do the right thing, guess what? You're just a probationary employee. I can't speak for the majority of agencies, but I know in LEPD, you're a temporary employee for 18 months. So from the time that you start the academy until the time that you finish probation, your probationary period's 1 year. You're a temporary employee, which means that you can get terminated at no cost whatsoever. And so I want to say there's a lot of agencies, and we both know that there's over 18,000 agencies throughout the United States. And a lot of them have a temporary probationary period. And if this was your dream job and this is what brings home, you're the moneymaker, you're going to do exactly what you were told to do. And that's how you develop bad habits. And, you're out there and it's just a matter of time, before you get caught.
Yeah. So in the course of your career, before you got into, IA things, what did you experience that perhaps led you toward looking into, going into IA?
Very, very good question. Look, in the Navy, believe it or not, in an aircraft carrier, I actually ended up being a legalman. I worked for the JAG inside an aircraft carrier, 5,000 sailors. And so my sole job was to prepare for these administrative hearings. They call it non-judicial punishments. They're also called captain's mass. So basically, like, let's just say you UA, unauthorized absence. You just don't show up to work. You don't show up to the boat one day. Well, that's a UA. And then I have to prepare that case for you to see the captain. And he or she is going to pretty much determine some type of punishment, right? Find you guilty and determine some kind of punishment. So that was back in like 1995. And I prepare cases for court martials as well. So you know what, Conrad, that's a very, very good question. All I can tell you is that you can fast forward from 1995 to 2007, 2008, when I got into discipline. I don't know, man. I like people's dirty laundry. Just, I'm curious. I'm curious to know, why you get in trouble, how you got in trouble, and what's going to be the outcome, right? And so that's kind of what drove me. At the time also, I was thinking about going to law school, which I ended up applying for law school. So just the, I suppose the light bulb just hit. And I took that quick left turn to say, you know what, this is something I'm very interested in. And I suppose it's because a lot of my time out in the streets and the other assignments that I had while I was in law enforcement, I always felt like people are disgruntled for certain reasons, meaning they get disciplined for something that they did, whether it was a traffic stop or a service radio call or, maybe a particular tactic during a use of force, and really honed in on, well, why do you feel this though? The department is, because what happens a lot of time is, there's not much self-accountability. But at times, even if you do the right thing, well, how am I supposed to hold myself accountable when the department's sitting there saying, well, you could have done things different, and therefore I'm kind of jam you up. I'm going to, hold you accountable for not doing this. And what I've learned, especially when it comes to applying force, the department doesn't scrutinize you for all the tactics that you applied during that incident. It's the tactics or the thinking about the things that you didn't do that gets criticized and scrutinized. And so I don't know. I think when I became sergeant, there was an opening in officer rep section. LAPD is so big that we had a whole unit that was dedicated to defending cops. And so back in 2008, I started getting interest into defending cops, whether it was a sustained complaint for neglect of duty or a violation of a policy and procedure. Officers will call the unit and they would say, hey, I need representation. A lot of other agencies don't have that luxury. I believe it's a union rep where they can call and say, hey, IA just got done serving me with this complaint and it's sustained. which means that it actually occurred. And I'm sitting here telling you that that's not the way it went down. That's not what happened. So I want to appeal it. You know, I want to submit a response. So that was a lot of my duties. So I started defending cops. And at the same time, I started responding to all these critical incidents, officer-involved shootings being the most popular, because they were happening a lot. I mean, LAPD in 1 year, I want to say we had close to 100. Imagine that.
Wow.
100 officer-involved shootings. And so when you respond to an OIS, your union attorney only represents the actual shooting officer. Guess who's left representing and ensuring that internal affairs doesn't violate the officer's rights, you know, during that incident? It's the rep. So we have to do a lot. I mean, we have to prepare for the partner and for everyone else that we determine that is substantially involved in this incident. So we call them percipient witnesses. So I gained a lot of that experience. And you know what? I really enjoyed it. I always felt like, at times, not all the time, I just want to be very, very clear, at times, the department gets it wrong. And when they get it wrong, you know, we should be there to hold them accountable and make a response. And you know what? Great minds don't always think alike, right? I mean, you and I can look at a IA complaint investigation and start framing these allegations, or we look at these allegations and you might come up with a whole different outcome than me. And it's okay to argue. The problem is that as a young officer, when you spend 3 or 4 years doing something right, and you've always done something right, and then all of a sudden here comes this IA complaint. Yeah, it's a stain, man. It's definitely not something that, you know, when you go home and tell your family, yeah, today I had a great day. No, today the department really passed judgment and scrutinized me for doing something that I believe was right, and they believe it was wrong.
How did the use of body-worn cameras change or shift the results of some of these investigations?
Tremendously, in my opinion, in our favor. Because we, and again, I'm the LAPD alumni, we actually have a policy for demonstrably false. When I teach the 2-day course with Savage Training Group, often the students are new sergeants and new lieutenants, newly, not so much seasoned, and maybe even officers are getting ready to get promoted. And there is a block of presentation that I talk about demonstrably false. We know what it is, and it involves body-worn video. So for example, if you and I are partners, and we're at our end of our shift, we're at the station, and some sergeant comes up to both of us, Marling and Conrad, and says, "Hey, man, you know what? I was over here at 7-Eleven getting a cup of coffee, and someone came up to me and said that you guys did a traffic stop and took grabbed someone and threw them up against the wall, you know, and used force." And you're like, "Well, I remember the traffic stop, but that's not what happened." Well, okay. Well, I'm just letting you know that there's an IA complaint being initiated, and I'm going to review your body-worn video and let this complainant know that perhaps that's not the way they saw it happen. And so, yeah, that's part of the advantage. That is the tool necessary to adjudicate and streamline a lot of these complaints, a lot of these allegations of misconduct. So I think it's a home run 100% in terms from a disciplinary lens that it changed. It was a game changer. I can tell you that the birth of body-worn video here in the state of California was in 2015. And I want to say by the beginning of 2016, a lot of police agencies in the state of California were waiting for LAPD to come up with their own policy. And once we finished and completed our policy and presented it to the state, right, a lot of agencies grandfathered themselves in and adopted our policy. And I want to say not many agencies actually have a definition of demonstrably false, you know, a policy by which you should guide yourself to say, okay, I can adjudicate this complaint as demonstrably false. So, we call it DF. DF in body worn video is a good thing. Now, of course, we can have a full-blown conversation how body-worn video has evolved. I mean, I just got done telling you that the birth of it was in 2015 here in the state of California. I mean, we're almost 10 years in, and there's a lot of experts out there and a lot of critics that can tell you that body-worn video is not the tell-all when it comes to a critical incident, which I agree. But I can't really speak in depth about how effective and how good of a tool it is when it comes to critical incidents.
Has it perhaps deterred some bad behavior that perhaps would have happened otherwise?
Perhaps. But if you're doing the right thing, whether you had body worn video 25 years ago or not, it shouldn't make a difference. What I think, and this is just my opinion, is, and I'm guilty of this too, is I think the language, right? What do they call that? Excited delirium. We can't use that word anymore for whatever reason, legally. But there's a lot of excitement and your emotions just go flying high when it comes to incidents, man. You know, someone starts dropping F-bombs and are very vulgar and disrespectful. Well, I suppose one of the ways to gain compliance is to act the same and get that respect. You know, some call it tactical language. Some call it, no, it's very inappropriate to talk that way. And that's the problem is that you don't know who the bosses are. You don't know who's, you know, in the levels of review, who's going to be determining whether or not, oh my God, I can't believe you told this guy to, you know, to F off like 20 times. Well, yeah, it took me 20 times to get him to comply, you know. Here he is, just got done committing a felony crime, and I'm sitting here trying to effect an arrest, and this guy's just not paying attention. And by the way, he's the one that actually dropped 30 F-bombs again. Not just me, all of us. So you see what I'm saying? So it's just that's just one aspect of deterrence. But you know what? I'm a true believer that if you if you're doing the right thing, and you know you come in this profession with a good heart, trying to do good work and to protect and to serve and all that good stuff, it shouldn't matter whether you have a video on or not.
What makes a good officer go bad?
Good question. Greed. Greed would be one.
So they're getting more opportunities to work overtime, to do...
Yeah. You know what? What's that saying? Desperate times call for desperate measures. And it's true. I mean, there's agencies out there that pay you bare minimum. And the opportunity for you to live a mediocre, right, to a great lifestyle is going to require for you to work more. And sometimes, you know, greed will get the best of you and you'll do anything to live a better life. And that's, who do we hold accountable? Do we hold, well, I mean, it's only obvious you hold the person who's out there being a rogue officer accountable for sure. But shouldn't a little bit of that responsibility also be on the law enforcement agency for not being able to remedy the fact that, look, man, we got these two officers that, you know, they went rogue because they just, they weren't making enough money and they needed money for whatever those reasons are. And that goes to the wellness, right? That gets that goes to the accountability about command staff, right? Management, getting to know your personnel and ensuring that, you know, you're coming to work, maintaining a healthy mind, right? Mm-hmm. A healthy conscience. And the other point to your question, I should say the other aspect or the other part of your question probably has a lot to do with, you know, how you're raised, mm-hmm. maybe your upbringing, you know, and these are just very psychological and personal ways that you were raised, whether you were neglected, you were abandoned, whether you were, no one considered you, there's no validity, affirmation, all those come into play. Mm-hmm. You could have been bullied all throughout your, you know, high school and junior high school and elementary, and this particular job empowers you to be that hierarchy and treat people bad. Mm-hmm. That could be one. So yeah, there's a lot of aspects, but the first one that comes to mind is greed, mm-hmm. With money, because it's happened.
Sure.
I have cases where, and you know this, where it's greed, man. You know, I don't make enough money. And, you know, maybe I'm trying to impress not just myself, but I'm trying to impress my family or live a better life. And guess what, man? I got corners to make more money, mm-hmm. and go rogue, mm-hmm. and go bad.
Is there still, I know back in the heyday of the mob and all that, there's a lot of, you know, stories about cops being paid under the table, being paid off. Is there still that going on in agencies across the country?
To my knowledge, no, Conrad. But what I will tell you is a lot of that has been weeded out. I mean, I can speak for, let's see, when I was in internal affairs as an advocate, as a prosecuting glorified attorney, cops that are facing termination. So I did about 30 plus of these border rights hearings. And we're the only agency that has this particular process by which there's a tribunal hearing, which we call a border rights. And it's like a full-blown, somewhat of a civil trial. Mm. And 30 of those that I prepared for, 5 of those were termination cases. In other words, one of the allegations was a false statement. And if you get caught for lying and you're found guilty, when we go to the penalty phase, you're going to get terminated. No one's going to save you when you're a liar. Mm-hmm. So we can agree, a bad actor, a bad apple, nobody wants, mm-hmm. In this organization, in this type of profession. But to your point, I can't think of any side handshake deals or anyone working, you know, behind the scenes to do favors one another. I want to say those days, and maybe I'm being a little naive, because again, there's 18,000 agencies. Right. Yeah. You know, so I suppose I'm being a bit naive to say that I don't necessarily think that's going on in today's policing. But the bigger problem, and we already touched on that, is the culture by which you cut corners, mm-hmm. and you become someone that you didn't, that's not what you signed up for. You signed up to take care of your community, to protect, you know, to service. And that's forgotten for all those personal reasons.
You know, and part of the transformation to me, looking at it from the outside, is, you know, cops face the worst of the worst every single day. And so you have this negative input constantly. You're just bombarded with the worst of society, right? And that yes. has to wear on you, you know.
100%. It has, on a personal note, it has changed me a lot in 25 years. You become numb mm. to conflict because you're just very quick to just say, okay, yeah, whatever. We just want to take it to jail and move on to the next radio call, the next service call. Mm-hmm. It has affected my personal life. Yeah, it caused me a divorce. Cost me to know a lot about myself and to be consistent in relationships, personal, mm-hmm. that is. Yeah, it does have a negative impact. Seeing the worst of the worst. And as you know, I have a podcast that's actually called Internal Affairs, mm-hmm. which is pretty unique because the type of content that we put out in this podcast is just specifically for guests to come in and tell me an IA story that we can learn from and get some takeaways. And I bring that up to say that in one of the segments of my show, I asked a guest for best and worst. So tell me the best time or what was rewarding or funny or something positive that happened in your career. And then we go to the worst. And out of the 23 guests, because I've had 23 episodes, each and every one of the guests always reaches to something just so tragic, a baby dying in front of them or seeing a heinous, grotesque type of murder where someone was killed. And, you know, it always involves childs and stabbings and, you know, you can imagine the worst of the worst that God has to offer. I couldn't agree with you more.
Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with that? And you know, not only in your podcast and you bring these guests on, but in your own history, in your own journey, you've seen the worst of the worst. How do you personally deal with that? And how do you kind of manage those thoughts and those memories that can flood your brain?
You know, my coping mechanism has always been to go to the gym. I like to think that I could have been a professional soccer player if I would have stayed home in Peru. I was born and raised in Lima, Peru, and soccer's my life. That's what I do, and that's my escape to this very day in my mid-50s. And I get together every Sunday with my, you know, con mi gente, you know, with my peoples, and we go out there for a whole hour and just, you know, go at it. So you gotta have an out, right? And that was working out and playing soccer was for me to keep my mind off it. But not everybody is built the same. Mm-hmm. For me, I've had military. I have a structure. Mm-hmm. I've always did ever since I was, you know, 23, 24 years old. So it wasn't really hard for me to adapt to those emotions that come with the job, especially the negative stuff that happens. I will tell you that when I used to work patrol from 4 in the afternoon until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I would actually come home and just watch ESPN, you know, just watch sports and just kind of take a deep breath and just relax. Some people, you know, will sip on some rum and some whiskey and to cope. Mm-hmm. And that's part of coping. But what ends up happening is that coping mechanism becomes a habit. Sure. And, you know, lucky for me, I didn't witness that many homicides or that many murders and that many critical incidents, but there is officers out there that do this every single day and they see it and they need that wellness piece. Mm-hmm. But what I can tell you, and we're going to segue into something that I want to advocate for is mental wellness. I can tell you, and again, I'm taking you back to 1999, 2000, 2001. I mean, that was over 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we didn't think about this stuff. Life coach or law enforcement coach or picking up the phone and because we're told not to. Sure. That's not what you do. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just surviving, especially on probation. Mm-hmm. You just want to get, go through probation and just finish. Mm-hmm. I had one of my good friends of mine, actually got into an OIS 3 months out of the academy. And that was over 20 years ago. And the shooting in it itself, to this very day, he still thinks about it because he was told, and this is coming from him. He, you know, he describes it way better than I do. But basically, when he came back from that, from the shooting, from the OIS, he felt as though he had to grab that experience and just put it on a shelf because he was told that you have to pass probation. Don't think about it. You're a temporary employee. You got to get through your 1 year and move on. And so you echo that towards the entire department, which at the time was 10,000 officers. Yeah, you know, we never paid attention or, provided that lens for us to say, hey, you know what? We need to talk to someone, or where can I go to cope with all the that God has to offer, mm-hmm. the worst. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that some of the things that officers get themselves into, you know, whether it's criminal behavior, whether it's just, you know, excessive use of force, do you think some of those incidents can be traced back to things that they've not taken care of, like, you know, mental health wise, that perhaps they're in a bad place and they're now reacting to a situation that they perhaps would have reacted differently if they'd have been healthy?
To some degree, I would say that could be a portion of why an officer decides to act in a way that they shouldn't be acting. I think the other portion is emotional intelligence. I think EI is huge to this very day. I don't know why, but not many police academies offer EI. Mm-hmm. I think EI is huge. Mm-hmm. I can't speak for women, obviously, because I'm not a woman, but for the most part, us men, you know, we got big egos. Mm-hmm. And when someone decides to raise their voice and, you know, disrespect us in a way where we're like, really? Mm. Okay, well, let me turn it up a notch and disrespect you because I'm the authority. Mm. I'm the boss here. I'm guilty of that too. I used to walk into radio calls. I remember domestic violence, for example. And here's the father that just, you know, he's the suspect, right? He just committed a felony and beat up his wife. And they would act like, you know, who the hell are you to come into my house? Which is true. Mm. Who are you coming into my home? And I remember I would say things like, you know what, look, here's the deal. Someone called 911 and you know what? I run the show here until I leave. Hmm. You know, I'm here. They'd ask to be here. Someone called. Hmm. And until I leave, I pretty much run the show. And you got to show that command presence. But the problem is that, and you know, I'm very competitive. You know, there's a lot of men who that testosterone just gets the best of you, man. And I think that's more of the portion that we need to focus on more so than the part where you see the worst and you didn't get, you know, you're not mentally healthy. Mm-hmm. That does play a role, but not completely. I just think a lot has to do with communication, the way we go about doing police work. It's not what it used to be. I know de-escalation's huge today in today's policing, where back in my days, I keep talking to people around, not just in LAPD, but in the state of California, there's a lot of colleagues of mine that were in the academy at the same time that I was, and they called the acronym ATM, Ask, Tell, and Make. We used to call it ATD, Ask, Tell, and Do. Sir, put your hands behind your head. No. F you. Okay. I'm telling you to put your hands behind your head. No, F you. And then you do it. Mm-hmm. And then the other academies, you make them, mm-hmm. you make it happen. So we've come far, you know, something as simple as that. So yeah, it has a lot to do with learning how to communicate. There's definitely a psychological component to this, but more than anything, there's an emotional component that I want to say we've gotten way better than we were 20 or 25 years ago. Mm-hmm.
In the things that you teach, you know, how do you help officers perhaps that have been accused of something and they're perhaps, like, for example, you know, I know of an officer who, you know, suffers from PTSD, and this officer was relieved of duty and largely because of that, but for some other incidents that perhaps happened. How do you help them get back into policing, or how do you help them walk through that difficulty? Because that's devastating, right? To
absolutely
be pushed to the side. Yeah.
The darkest moments in your life is when you're facing discipline and you're relieved from duty. How do I help? Well, I put myself out there in these classes with Savage Training Group to let these new sergeants know that, listen, if you're going to be doing this type of function as an investigating officer in internal affairs, you got to set your ego aside. You have to set your relationships aside, and you have to be very fair and very impartial. And in addition to that, don't have any expectations. Don't be that one sergeant that's going to say, oh, yes, I got this complaint. Yeah, I know him. I know this happened. So all these pre-notions about you having against one particular accused officer, right? You got to let that go, man. That's not the type of investigator, certainly, that I wouldn't want, and I'm sure the community doesn't want, and certainly that the organization doesn't want. And so that's where the teaching component comes in. And we didn't know this 20 years ago, right? And so I try real hard to let them know. It's not that I try hard, but I convey a lot of these conversations during our blocks of instruction to know that you decide to do this. The motto that I always say is no stone goes unturned. Just make sure that whatever it is that you're doing, it's not cutting corners, especially as an investigator. Your job is to gather as much evidence as possible. And whatever evidence that you gathered and where it leads you, go for it. If it takes that one phone call that you have to make and you're not getting an answer from the complainant or a witness, then you know what? Get in your car and go drive and go over there. Go door knock it. Leave a business card. Do whatever it is that you have to. Maybe go to the post office and see if that particular person actually lives there. So exhaust all your investigative tools to exonerate that officer. And now I do sound a little biased, but sometimes you can't help it but to be biased. Because if I knew Conrad from the academy, he was my classmate. And this applies more to a smaller agency than a big agency like LAPD or the Sheriff's Department. And you and I were the best of friends. Our families know each other. We get together for, you know, holidays and the whole nine. And then I make sergeant and I'm here I am at 7-Eleven or trying to get a cup of coffee. By the way, I say 7-Eleven because that's what we have out here. And I know that's
we have Wawa here East Coast. Or Sheets.
Okay, so we go to Wawa. So here I am at Wawa trying to get a cup of coffee. And then someone decides to say, hey, you know what? I saw these two officers down the street. They pull someone over and they threw up against the wall. And it happens to be Conrad. Well, the first thing I'm going to be thinking is there's just no way. I worked with Conrad for 10 years. I just promoted to sergeant and now I'm in internal affairs. So yeah, you better believe I'm going to do everything possible with the tools that I have to be a really good investigator and exonerate Conrad. God forbid that this evidence leads me to believe that perhaps Conrad did actually, and the partner, right? They did throw up, I'm sorry, not throw up, threw this person or they grabbed this person and threw up against the wall. You know, and so it just, those are the kind of conversations that are so important to have. Whoever's listening out there as a young sergeant, as a young officer, to have that communication and know that if you are getting into this type of function in internal affairs and discipline, that is to do your job and just do it very, very good, you know.
What do you do with officers who, you know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, they start coming home and they have, you know, a glass of bourbon and now they find themselves, you know, at the bottom of the bottle too many times and there's a problem. How do you, as an arbitrator, how do you, as someone who has, you know, kind of work with officers that got themselves into trouble because of their extracurricular drinking, you know, what do you do with that? You know, how do you handle that?
Well, I would imagine in today's law enforcement agencies, you're able to identify that. For one, you have to self-admit that you need help, right? That's the first step, like any other addiction,
sure,
if you will, because now we're stepping into the alcohol addiction, and certainly something that I don't know. But first step is self-admit and then have command staff wrap yourself around that individual and provide them the help. I would imagine the remedy now is completely different than it was 20 years ago. Someone who's facing something like that, you got to call, man. If you're listening and you're, you know, to this to this podcast, do yourself a favor and make that call and have someone, because nowadays we have law enforcement coaches. Mm-hmm. We do. Mm-hmm. We have people who can actually relate to your situation. I believe they call that it's called the responsivity principle. What that means is that you should be able to match and adapt the styles and the modality of that person that needs that therapy and those sessions. So in other words, if I'm a police officer and I am coming home and the only way that I can cope with all this madness, you know, that the world has to offer, these heinous crimes and everything that I'm going through, I'm not just going to call a 1-800 number and get some psychologist that, for all I know, you might have been a marriage family mm-hmm. therapist, or your clinical or forensic. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You're not a cop, so you don't understand. So in efforts to match that style and modality and to be responsive is to perhaps call someone who was an alcoholic, who did admit to being an alcoholic, and can call you and say, hey, let's go to Starbucks and have a cup of coffee and kind of talk about this. And if you need me to walk you through this whole process, you know, through moments of darkness, I'm here for you. I'm a cop. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a 25-year veteran. I went through exactly what you went through. I lost it all. I lost my wife. I lost my job. I've been criminally filed on, for that matter. So there's a lot of these firms mm-hmm. and, you know, private firms mm-hmm. that are offering that services. I want to say some agencies are actually negotiating contracts with their unions to provide this type of service, which is mm-hmm. great. So that's the way to do it, where before we didn't do that at all.
What brings you the most joy in the work that you do now?
The fact that I can tell a sergeant or advise a sergeant that I did everything I could in this particular investigation, that brings me a lot of joy. You know what brings me more joy? And it's tough for me to say this because I am an internal affairs alumni, is when the department gets it wrong. Mm. That's what brings me joy. Mm. Because more often than not, and I say this all the time, we do it to ourselves. Mm. We get it wrong. Mm-hmm. And you know what, Conrad? We shouldn't be doing that. All it takes sometimes is, don't have that knee-jerk reaction. Just give it time to, don't have those expectations. That's what I said earlier, right? Mm-hmm. Give it time to really, really think about what we are doing in terms of providing discipline against this officer. That's what brings me joy. It brings me joy when the department's saying, hey, we're accusing you of violating these particular policies, and you neglected to do or failed to do this, this, and that. And then we're able to prove that you got it all wrong. Mm-hmm. That brings me joy. But then again, let's put it in perspective. I come from a big, big machine. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that we understand that. And I'm only talking about a very, very small fraction of incidents and investigations that the department got it wrong. Problem is that in a small agency, it sticks out
sure.
like a sore thumb. Yeah. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. can you imagine being in a department of just 80 sworn personnel and we're accusing you of violating all these policy and procedures, and next thing you know, you get it wrong. Mm-hmm. But guess what? Everybody knows,
you
know, and then how do you deal with that? So that brings me joy. I wouldn't say in terms of joy when you do get found guilty, mm-hmm. or I should say you're accused, it's sustained. So these allegations were sustained, which means that it actually occurred. It brings me more happiness. I shouldn't say happiness, but fairness. Mm-hmm. I feel a little bit more relieved if you actually render a very reasonable penalty. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Kind of like in the situation that you just brought up. You know, you're violating policy and procedure. You're terminating someone. Really? Is that the most fair and reasonable penalty that we can come up with? You know, so, but joy, yeah, as much as I hesitate to say this, it brings me a lot of joy when the department gets it wrong.
Interesting thought there. That was not what I was expecting
good
to
question.
Hear. Yeah. So, well, what is...
good? But...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, but, you know, in my line of field, that's... I'll never forget when I was a defense rep in officer rep section, and we went to an administrative appeal hearing. We're challenging these allegations. We are arguing before you to submit to you that these sustained allegations, we want you to overturn the chief's decision and make them unfounded. And we have the evidence to prove that. And when they ruled in our favor, oh yes, that brought me a lot of joy. Not in a sense that, you know, I'm sticking it to the department, and I'm pounding my chest. I'm not making an announcement or going on social media saying, hey, you know, look, we won. No, it's just that reasonable minds at times, like these circumstances, don't agree. We don't agree, you know, and that's just the way it works. So
I suppose over the years, you probably made some not so good friends.
Well, I tell people, you know what, Marlon's a sweetheart. Marlon is, you know, charismatic, enthusiastic. I'm always smiling. I'm having even my closest enemies. I got attorneys that, you know, we've gone toe to toe, and you know, and to this very day, we're cordial, and we're the best of friends. I never really thought about that. I had one host over a year ago ask me, "Hey, when you went to internal affairs, you must have just made enemies." What I will tell you is, when I got into internal affairs, especially in this job, yeah, you're right. No one just likes internal affairs in the first place. But you know what? If Marlon was working your case, a lot of my ex-partners, a lot of my classmates will tell you that Marlon's being fair and reasonable. I'm not going out of my way to make this self-serving. I can only present the facts. And again, I told you 30 of these hearings, only 5 were termination cases. They found him guilty for false statements, and we moved on. The question's always been, and what's been on my mind is those other 25 cases that I tried, that I put on, just didn't even merit them being there. And a lot has to do with the quality of the investigation. Maybe there was a personal vendetta. Maybe it was self-serving to the levels of review. And you know what? And that's even us as in internal affairs, we'll go to these hearings like, yeah, well, we're just going to have to go through the motions, but we don't have the evidence to prove that, at least I should say the standard of proof is preponderance, right? More likely than not, 51%. I mean, we don't even have 40%, but we have to go through the motions, which kind of sucked. That wasn't a really good feeling as well. But yeah, I didn't make that many enemies. And I suppose what drives me to do what I do today and to teach the next generation about internal affairs is because of that stigma. It's exactly what you just stated. It's the fact that I didn't have many friends when I got to internal affairs. I mean, we're known. I mean, you've heard the nicknames, right? Rat Squad, the Dark Side, many, many other nicknames. And I've always wondered why it's been like that for decades. Someone reminded me that there was an episode in Dragnet back in the 40s where internal affairs was, you know, they're evil. You know, they're the worst. You know, don't talk to them. So, yeah, we're trying our best to break that stigma.
Awesome. Well, as we wrap up here, what is there something on your mind that you want to bring up, that you want to talk about?
A couple of things. So one, if you're listening to this and you're a sworn, you know, officer or sergeant or even a lieutenant or even command staff, come join one of our classes at Savage Training Group. I'll give you all the information about that. And more important than anything, too, for me, as you can tell, I'm very passionate about this stuff. I started this podcast called Internal Affairs, a Police Podcast. Please look us up at YouTube channel. I like to describe it as rich in content. It really is. All of our guests are really giving some really good stories, not just to tell the story about reliving something that just at times is not joyful, right? But there's a lot of lessons learned, man. There's a lot of takeaways. I have guests that are adjudicators, right? Mm-hmm. Command staff officers, managers. That come in and tell you from their lens, hey, you know, let me tell you about a time when they adjudicated this one IA complaint. I have guests who are investigating officers that are going to tell you about the job. Let me tell you about this one case that really stood out where we're going to get some takeaways. And some of the guests are actually accused sworn officers who are going to tell you, yes, I did take a hit. I'm holding myself accountable. I was suspended and I was able to deal with adversity through those dark moments and look at me now. So again, it's good stuff. Please subscribe and all that good stuff. And last but not least, look, this is a great profession. I know that the numbers of trying to get good candidates to do this profession has really been very, very low for obvious reasons. But don't stop and forget that this is a noble profession. It's afforded me a lot of success. I still think it's a you can do something really good, you know, and do right by your peers and by the community, and just be flexible. Don't you know? Don't let this job get to you emotionally. And you know, sometimes you got to put your ego on the side and just do what's best. So yeah. Sign up, man. It's a great profession. And thank you for having me, Conrad. I really appreciate
it. Awesome. I'll be sure to put all those links in the show notes so people can access your show. Thanks so much, Marlon, for being here. Thank you for the work that you're doing. And one final thing, what's one word of advice you could give to an officer that's out there on the streets? What would you tell them?
Don't forget to go code six. Don't forget to be at scene. You need to be where you're at. And if you happen to do a follow-up to another location, definitely update your location. You just never know what's going to happen. In other words, you do a traffic stop, or you go to a service call, make sure you tell everybody that you're at scene, because you just never know what's going to happen. Please be safe out there.
Awesome. And we'll leave it at that. Thanks, Marlon, for spending time with me today on the podcast. I really enjoyed our conversation. And a big thank you to all of you who have taken time to listen, to watch, and especially if you've taken time to leave a review. I really do appreciate that. And if you haven't left a review, please do so. I want to be sure I'm bringing content to you that you want to hear, and your reviews matter. And remember, you are not alone. If you need someone to talk to and don't know where you can turn, you can dial 988 for help. Be sure to tune in next week for another interview with an amazing first responder leader. And until then, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something great in the world.